Mr. Cybert, Reel 4. Now, as you were on this job with Reese Force, and you mentioned earlier that you were on putting the barbed wire entanglements down, the rest of it, for about 3 months. What actually happened to the unit? I mean, it was
as time progressed, the group itself, the unit, it lost quite a number of men due to illness. There was virtually no real equipment with clothing or anything. Lots of the chaps had nothing more than their boots and their shorts. Out of clothing and just worn out. And so these people were walking around with just their boots and their shorts on, covered in sores. And they disbanded and sent the whole lot back to the base depot.
And where would this be? Would this be before or after the Alamein?
It was before Alamein. I would think it was probably sometime in. Let's see, Alamein was November.
October, I think. But
It would probably been in September, late August, September, something like that. And so we all went back to the base depot.
What was the base depot like? I perhaps should have asked you beforehand. You were honorary life members, but what was going on in the depot?
The usual practice of numerous NCOs ensuring that everybody else was sent out, but not them, and life being made unpleasant in general. When we arrived back at the base depot, there was immediate horror that RFG YG had returned. The riot act was read because of the lack of discipline. There was one verse of mutiny, in fact. They read out the King's rules and regulations.
What were the draft of it? You were still. I hadn't realised that Reese Force was. A good part of Reese Force was this draft.
The whole of RFG YG were on it. And,
so, how did they behave themselves then while they were doing the work, from the sound of it?
We were in small groups, but what the rest were doing, I don't know. But I know that when we got back to the base depot, we were made to sit on the parade ground for 2 days, surrounded by. Military police and NCOs to cool everybody down. And so we were 2 days on the playground without food or water in the blazing sun.
What had they done? I mean, had they done anything, or was that a precaution?
They were just completely out of hand.
How did you feel being part of this draft that had this awful reputation? Because you hadn't.
I didn't think anything about it at that time. You know, to me, things have become all part of life. You accepted these things. And, of course, even so, what was I being about 19 at the time, I suppose, at 20, but still hadn't learned the ways of the world. You see, when you grew up in a society where, which at that time, everybody touched their caps and lived in fear of the doctor or the dentist or the headmaster or the local priest, you did what you were told.
So what happened in 2 days? And you were out in the parade now for 2 days. What happened then?
Well, everybody was called down sufficiently to do what they were told. And life went back to normal, if one can call it normal. I started to get ill then.
What with?
Typhoid. Which I picked up out there. I probably got it.
Did you realise what it was? I mean, or were you diagnosed quickly?
No. I spent about first week there feeling half dead.
What symptoms?
Throat, sore in temperature. We had a doctor there, Captain Weir, you can put that name down if you like. He had a reputation throughout the Middle East. He was a drunkard, and everybody was a malingerer. And he used to go into his tent, he'd got chickens on his desk, fowls on his desk, for he must have fresh eggs. And I went there. I was a malingerer. And I went back a couple of days later, malingerer. Third time I went back, if I went again, I'd be put on charge. So I went back for gas mask drill, and in that gas mask drill, which was getting on for late in the day, I collapsed. And they put me on a special academy, so that's the MO's tent, and he was not there, he was drunk as usual, and the medical told him to take me straight to the hospital in Kohala, which would happen to be the 5th South African hospital.
And you were by then, from the sound, it pretty bad.
Mm, yeah, I was. So there we are, and I was in there for about 3 weeks before I was diagnosed as having typhoid. And of course, during that whole time, I was getting weaker and weaker. I hadn't eaten anything for weeks. Couldn't eat anything. And they could bring food around. And of course, these were South Africans in the wall there. I was in the tent. And the chap in the next, in the opposite place, was eating my food. And they didn't know it. And what happened was that the porters took my dinner round as usual. Tiffin, I think they called it, put it on the other side of my bed, and this South African from the opposite side promptly came over. He was just a matter of routine for him then. He took it and was sitting down eating it. And the sister walked into the tent, and they were getting quite concerned about me by then. And she said, where's your meal? Oh, she called, and I was too weak to answer or bother. And she called in the office. She said, where's this man's food? He said, well, I brought it and put it down there. So she said, well, where is it? And this other fellow, they was turned around and looked at him and saw he'd got two plates there. And she said, go up in the air. This chap was supposed to, this South African was supposed to be in with stomach trouble. And the next time I was sort of aware of what was going on, next thing I saw happening was that two or three doctors arrived, and they stuck tubes there, this fellow's throat. And he was, for a couple of days, he was sitting there with tubes sticking down. And then he suddenly decided he wanted to be discharged. So off he went. But they were trying to get me to eat. I couldn't eat anything. And they eventually found that they diagnosed typhoid. So,
what was the treatment for typhoid?
None. There was no cure for it at that time. No treatment. And so it was my hard luck. You either survived or you didn't. And so I was moved into an isolation hall where there were some cases of typhus and other sorts of complaints where people had to be isolated. And
you must have been a big risk of giving more people typhoid before you were diagnosed.
I suppose so, yes.
And what happened in the isolation ward?
Well, I was for about 6 months in lying flat on my back. Apparently, your stomach gets ulcerated. You get hold of your stomach is ulcerated, and you can't. But they won't let you move for fear of these ulcers bursting. But have about 6 months flat on that. And at that time, alamein occurred.
Was there any question of you being sent home? I mean,
no, because when I had recovered and was discharged, the South African doctor told me that if I'd have been in that all the South Africans were sent home and discharged from the army, invalided out of the army, but he said because I was a British soldier, they couldn't do that. I've got to go back to the British Army. And they sent me to a convalescent camp in near Alexandra called Agamy Point.
Agamy Point?
Yeah, A-G-A-M-I, I always remember that.
And what was it like there?
Well, it was at the time that Montgomery ordered everybody that conditions to be made so bad in the convalescent camps that everybody would want to get out. So I arrived there and the next day went out on a 5 mile run, which of course was ridiculous. I just couldn't hobble, let alone run. And so on the third day I went to the MO and said, will you send me back out to a unit somewhere? And he looked very surprised, but he said, you sure? I said, yes. So he said, well, I'll send you back to the base depot. So I went back to the base depot, and first thing there was to see the MO, and he looked surprised. He said, why are you back here? I said, because I'd asked to be sent out of the convalescent camp.
That wasn't Weir this time.
No, Weir. I hope he died. He drank himself to death, whatever he did. No, it was a, he said, oh. So he said, well, he said, put you on a month's light duty and come back and see me in a month. And so I spent the next month peeling potatoes very happily. And then the next month, again peeling potatoes very happily. And saw him again. He said, well, he said, I'm going to send you to a unit on the along the Red Sea. He said, well, you won't find it too bad there. And so I was posted out. I can't remember the name of the unit now, except they were all Yorkshiremen.
What was it?
Artillery, yeah.
And anti-aircraft?
Yes, but I was driving then. And
when did you learn to drive? Or could you drive always?
They must have taught me to drive in Almaza during that time I was there, yes. In the last month I was put on a driving course, that's right. And I was told to report to the orderly room before I went, and I was told to take a chap with me and take him and deliver at a certain point in Port Said. And whatever I have happened, I was not to allow him to get near any natives. It was a right one. So there we are. So I took him down to where it was, also I sat there and took him into this particular place, but he was a real...
What was he doing? I mean, he just hated the Egyptians, did he? What was up with him? Was he mad?
And then today they use a beautiful English word called gays. But in those days they called them guftos, weirders, brown hatters, anything. And that's what he was. And evidently he liked the natives. So the natives liked him. Perhaps you better cut that bit out.
So then what happened? What's your next job?
Oh, well, I was... mostly we spent quite some months, I forget exactly how long, on the that's all right. The Red Sea there. And
what was the unit doing? I mean,
it was a gun site protecting probably Suez. Yes, but it was near a place called Moses Wells, which was a first World War battleground of some sort, probably, because as you drove about there in the desert, you could there was still barbed wire entanglements, etc., from the First World War, and tins lying around.
So you were just driving?
Yes, I was just driving.
Were you getting fitter in yourself, putting a bit of weight back on, or?
Well, as I said earlier, I was always quite a lightweight, probably. But in the hospital, I had gone down to the stage where the nurse could just pick me up like that when they were making the beds. And I remember once when I started to eat, I was given a bar of chocolate and couldn't break it.
And you were improving a bit from that state, though.
Yeah.
Did they put you on a program to build up your fitness, or were you just left to it?
No, I was just that the wisdom of the medical officer had been sent there to because they knew it was a cushy spot. And it was. It was quite lovely there, really.
And how long were you with them? Unless
they moved to. They left there and they went back into the desert to Benghazi, where there was a gun site there. And again, I was doing the same sort of job. They were mainly, by that time, they'd established the, I think it was the American 5th Air Force. They had a huge airdrome there. And, you know, you were taking off and they're going on these bombing raids on Eastern Europe. I remember watching them take one for the oil fields in Romania one day. And they would circle for hours and hours, in forming up into giant formations. And when they came back, they were certainly in trouble. They lost a lot of planes, I'd say. Ploesti, I think, something like that they were after. And there they had a searchlight used to beam all night, so they could see a signal out in the med.
Were there any Italian or German air raids during this time on you?
Not there. There had been some in the desert and that. We did have, there were a lot of. They'd captured enormous amounts of breeder guns, and these anybody could fire them if there was an alarm of some sort. They used to run to the nearest one and fire it in the air.
These are Italian automatic?
Italian light machine guns, or heavy machine guns, breeders.
Were they fixed to poles? How were they fixed to foreign?
Well, the ones we had were on some sort of tripod arrangement.
And did these shoot anything down, or?
No, they actually put up terrific barrages. The whole sky would be absolutely crisscrossed with them, firing in all directions. And it was amazing, the flak that went up.
And what about the three? Were there 3.7s the unit had as well?
Yes, but I'm talking about earlier times now, not for that.
Oh, sorry.
No, I don't recollect them ever.
You mean when you were with Reese Force?
Yes. Mm.
So what's the next thing that happened? You were at Benghazi, guarding the 5th US Air Force base. Mm.
We went... we suddenly had orders to... mind you, all orders were sent. We had orders to go to... Syria, but we didn't know. I didn't know where we were going at the time. But what I understand that about that time they were trying to get Turkey to enter the war, and they sent so many divisions of British troops to into Syria to walk a Turkish border, waiting to enter Turkey. And that's where we went. We would spend the winter of 43 on the Turkish border, waiting to go in. We just went straight from Benghazi, and drove all the way past Damascus. I forget how long it took us to do this, but it was more or less non-stop. I mean, all we were doing was just stopping there and going to sleep. But we drove us from Benghazi to past beyond Damascus. And finished up towards the Turkish border. We were at a place called, they'd established a camp and they called it Forfar. You know, a Scottish team, football team. And that's where we were.
And what were you actually doing? You were still driving.
Waiting, our usual guard and waiting. But because it was a winter, it was a fierce winter. And
Well, I mean, you just come from the desert. The winters can be vicious up there.
They were, and we had quite a lot of number of Bechuanas and black troops. A lot of Bechuanas. They were labour troops and whatnot. And we were all issued with four blankets apiece. And after a short week or so, they found that there were so many of these Bechuanas, these black troops, were becoming ill with the cold and whatever, pneumonia and whatnot, that they took their blankets away and left us with one blanket. And the other three blankets were given to the black troops. So they had seven blankets apiece, and we had one. But as usual, we found ways of getting around it. We I don't know if you have seen these bibbies that were issued.
What were they like? What were they like? Which type?
Well, they were like a very small tent, and just room for two. And I seem to recollect that they split in two on the top, and each of you carried one piece each. I think, I'm not quite sure about that, but what we did was to get together in groups of about eight, I think, and we'd put half the bivvies and half the blankets on the ground, and the other half on top, and I think it was about eight of us used to crowd in, all with leather clothes on, and greatcoats, and jerkins, these leather jerkins we've got, and waders, rubber boots, and we'd all crowd in underneath it, as warm as anything.
It doesn't sound like there was much point to this. I mean, Turkey didn't come into the war.
Turkey, and then we came back again, and I'm not quite. I think it must have been about that time. Oh yes, we came back to our Marza, and we started training for Italy.
Now, so do you mean the unit was broken up? This Yorkshire unit?
Yes.
Because at that point, I believe there was a policy of breaking up anti-aircraft units and feeding them into the infantry, because there weren't enough infantry. How did you feel when they told you that was what was going to happen?
I was not concerned. Not concerned at all. But,
had you recovered your normal health then?
In hindsight, no.
And what forms of infantry training did there was Armada?
Now Weir must have been alive, but that was back again. Yes, the quite a lot of what they called the ship's sides. They had structures. I think they were basically corrugated iron, which went up about 40 feet, perhaps, and with nets, ropes hanging from the sides. And there was all this practice for ship size. This was for the nets that would be hanging from the ships to disembark. And so you would have to climb up them and over the top and round the other side, and there was all this pole throwing and all this sort of nonsense. But
any more small arms training? Because you'd had that rifle training. It was a long time ago then.
Oh, well, we always did have the small arms and the brains. We always had those.
So you were up to date with them?
We knew how to operate those. And of course, there were other things which you never hear of, sticky bombs.
You got practice in them, did you? Grenades.
Well, I think they were earlier. Did you ever come across sticky bombs? I think by then they'd gone altogether. I don't know if I've seen them in the latter part of the war at all. And there were spigot mortars. Did you come across spigot mortars? They were amazing things.
When did you have them?
We must have had them when we were in Marine School. Because they were amazingly accurate. I remember the first time I fired one, it just lay down there on the ground, on the sand with this spigot, and fired at a derelict tank, and about 200 yards, I think it was. It was quite a distance, and the first time I fired it, it smacked on, and most of them were like that. This wretched mortar could knock a truck over. It was amazing. I don't know why I suppose they weren't mobile enough.
They were very heavy, weren't they?
Yes, very heavy. Because they were very wide.
So you trained with these while you were with Reese Force?
Probably, yes.
So you'd had quite a bit of infantry training overall.
Oh, yes.
What about the tactics of infantry fighting? Did you get...
Oh, yes, they loved it. Tactics, blobs and all this sort of nonsense. And I don't know.
When were you taught that?
Oh, quite early on. Wouldn't have never surprised me if it hadn't told you to form up in a square or something. Quite early. So early that it must have been an early part of the war. It could have even have been with the LDV.
So, you weren't getting... What sort of... You'd had this going over the side at the disembarkation...
It was mostly fit for fitness, all this training. This ship's side, I remember one chap, this is why I said that weir must have been alive. One lad fell from the top. Just a very high, 30, 40 feet, and of course he was unconscious. And we were all in just shorts and boots. And a corporal, or the bombardier, Lance Bombardier, they got a stretcher, and I was one of the on one end of the stretcher, and we carried him over to the medical officer, who was Weir. And it's very hard to believe, but we carried this chap into the tent, and Weir said to the Lance Bombardier, "What do you mean by bringing that man into my tent improperly dressed?" So we had to take him out, go and get some clothes for him, dress him and take him back in, by which time he was dead. Sounds impossible to believe, doesn't it?
And that actually happened?
Yeah.